Good.
So I see that you are, you're fresh and happy.
Okay, good.
So I have to work much more than all the others. I don't know exactly why, but I will take things slowly. Now let me first tell you what I'm not going to do. Well, most of the things that I could do, I'm not going to do. You heard a lot about different interpretations of the measurement problem, probabilities, and so on. And for quite a while, this was considered to be the subject, the foundations of quantum mechanics. Now, this is a very important problem, obviously, because we have a formalism, and we get the formalism gives us some equations, and then we have to see what they actually mean in the laboratory. And it's obviously a non-trivial problem, since people have worked on it for so long, and there is absolutely no consensus. And if somebody tries to tell you that there is consensus and they found a solution, just don't believe them. But at the same time, this tells us that probably at the moment there is not too much hope of finding a solution for this particular problem. So it's probably not the most fruitful thing to talk at the moment. That is on one hand. On the other hand, there are many more interesting problems in quantum mechanics than just dealing with the measurement problem and interpretations of probabilities. You know, the behavior of quantum particles is extremely, extremely different from the behavior of classical particles. And the way that is so different is reflected by the fact that we always discover new so-called quantum paradoxes, you know, things that defy our intuition. That was the case with tunneling in the early days of quantum mechanics. Then, I don't know, interaction-free measurement, Bell inequalities, Hardy's paradox, and so on. And the simple fact that we find this paradoxical means that we do not have a good intuitive understanding of the quantum phenomenon. And we need to develop this. So what I will try to talk is just about quantum behavior in general. And I will not discuss at all interpretations. So as far as I'm concerned, interpretation could be Copenhagen or could be the projection postulate, and I will encourage questions for anything else, but don't stop me about the particular way of interpreting the results of the measurement, because for all practical purposes, all the different interpretations say the same thing. But it's interesting, what is the quantum phenomena that takes you up to that moment? Now, it is my view that there are three main aspects of quantum mechanics that one has to understand in order to get to a better understanding of quantum mechanics itself. One of these is entanglement. And entanglement has recently been investigated quite extensively, especially in the context of quantum information. Entanglement, and together with it, non-locality, in the sense of Bell, in the sense of Bell inequalities, correlations between the results of measurements on two particles at a distance. But this is only one aspect. I'm going to talk today about other two aspects. And those are, so let me put here entanglement. Which, in a sense, it is kinematic non-locality. It is non-locality that emerges due to the Hilbert space way in which the set of quantum states is described in quantum mechanics. So you don't need to know anything about equations of motion or anything else in order to derive Bellian qualities. The other thing is what I would call dynamical, not locality. And here I will also put a technical thing, modular variables. And the third important thing, well, technically let me put pre and post selected selection and weak measurements. But more generally, this has to do with the time flow in quantum mechanics. So I'm going to concentrate on these two things. About entanglement and more locality, there is a lot of material out there, and you can easily find out. These two things are virtually unknown. Now, ideas about dynamical more locality originated with Yakira Haronov. Aharonov Bohm effect. These ideas originated in the early 60s, and there are a couple of papers about them, not too many. Pre and post selection also comes from Yakira Haronov. The first paper started in 64, but then really the whole thing started in late 80s. All of these are well known before quantum information and well before the general interest in foundations of quantum mechanics. So today I will talk about dynamical non-locality, and tomorrow I will talk about pre and post selection. That's it. Okay. So what is the dynamical non-locality? Let me start with a very, very simple example, which is the standard example that is discussed in all good textbooks of quantum mechanics, in particular Feynman, which is the two slit experiment, in which you have a source here that emits, say, an electron. The electron goes through a screen that has two slits. It emerges like two wave packets. These two wave packets continue, they interfere, and if you repeat this example many times, you will get an interference pattern. And this is the probability distribution of the spots on this photographic plate that you obtain. Now, generally, this problem is discussed, well, you know, first lecture of quantum mechanics in the context of wave-particle duality and so on. Well, here you have an interference which is very much wave-like, if you think in the wave function of the particle. But then the particle behaves, well, then this quantum object behaves like a particle by giving a hit in one of the places on the photographic plate. And Feynman said that this contains probably all the mystery of quantum mechanics. However, this standard way of looking at it is somehow misleading if you start thinking a bit more of it. Because all the interesting part that is a propagation is viewed as a simple wave phenomenon. And at that stage you say, well, that part is really trivial. It's exactly like an ordinary wave, like in acoustics or like in classical optics. It's nothing interesting. I just have a wave function, psi of x, that is a superposition of two things, psi 1 of x plus psi 2 of x, I will put here the normalization in front of it. And they just interfere, and I know everything about interference. And in fact, let me also add a relative phase between these two things. And when I modify the relative phase, these things, this interference pattern moves on the screen, and everything is very trivial. Perhaps you already learned about this in high school, or definitely first year of university. Now, there cannot be anything more misleading than thinking that this is a pure classical interference. And the reason is that the relative phase between these two wave packets is non-local. What do I mean by that? If I look on waves on the ocean, water waves, I can sit next to one of these slits, and I see how the wave is going, up and down and up and down, and I can look at my clock and say, well, at 12 o'clock, it was up. Some other, a friend of mine looks there, at 12 o'clock, it was down. So we can find the relative phase between these two things on a local experiment. Now, quantum mechanically, you know that an absolute phase in front of the wave function has no meaning, is unobservable. So then let me write this psi of x as being e to the I alpha over root 2, e minus I alpha psi 1 of x plus psi 2 of x. So all I did was to take e to the I alpha in front of it. Now you know that this is unobservable. It's an overall phase in front of the wave function. It doesn't influence anything. But what happened here is that I moved the phase from psi 2 that lives here next to this slit, I move it to psi 1 that lives next to the other slit. So by this simple trick, I can show that, and by the fact that an overall phase has no meaning, you immediately realize that the phase is not something that an observer located next to one of the slits could have measured. It is only the relative phase between the two slits that is important, but locally, the phase has no meaning. So already at this point, there is a dramatic difference between the classical view of interference and the meaning of interference in quantum mechanics.
I have a question.
Yes?
So, we have two problems with that. Firstly, you can always not project onto the real numbers, but onto some complex vector, if you do like classical physics. So replace 1 by 1 to the I alpha, and then describe your classical wave as a complex function. And then if you project onto that number, then you can, if you change both of them, the overall phase doesn't matter. And secondly, if you have a wave propagating, it's because if you have time shift symmetry, for example, then the overall phase can also, it's then only the relative phase is relevant.
It was a complicated thing, and I'm afraid that I don't understand it properly. If this is a dam on a lake and the waves are coming, I can see whether it's up or down. Okay, I will not put like complex numbers, I put like sine and cosine is the same. It really doesn't matter. So the phase of the wave, and not only the overall amplitude, has a local meaning. Quantum mechanically, it doesn't.
Only together with some notion of where your time starts, because otherwise you can shift yourself by a fraction of a second and then.
Okay, if my time is fixed, and I can have, that's a good point. But if the time is fixed in quantum mechanics, I still can't do it. So there is a difference. I assume here time synchronization as being given. So there are no problems from this point of view. and there is still a difference. Okay, so let's try and get a better understanding of what is happening. Yes, please.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again.
Yes.
I don't quite see why that trick tells you that phase is gone away.
Oh, because by now, this guy has phase zero, and this has phase minus alpha. Well, previously, this had phase alpha, and this had phase zero.
So the idea is that the phase should be, the conservative should be able to change it.
The relative phase is well defined. The absolute phase doesn't have any meaning.
Right.
Local. Okay. Now let me go and play with this. To make the situation simpler, I will, instead of discussing of this two-dimensional thing in x and y, just on a single dimension x. And let me take a wave function that is composed out of two wave packets. So psi of x, and I put psi alpha of x, would be 1 over root 2 psi 1 over plus e to the I alpha psi 2 of x. Now, depending, here I'm talking about a general family of states indexed by the relative phase alpha. The relative phase has a meaning, so let me talk about that. Now, let me take the two-wave packets, psi 1 and psi 2, for simplicity, let me really take them with compact support. That is, psi 1, it's really defined only here, and has no overlap with psi 2, that is defined only there. Okay. And also, for simplicity, let me take them to be exactly the same wave packet. If I take them differently, it's just mathematical complication. Okay. So what I would like to ask now, you know, every observable in quantum mechanics is, for a single particle, is a function of x and p, where x is the position and p is the momentum. So my question is, which observable contains information about the relative phase? Now, the relative phase is important because the relative phase is the one that tells me where is this interference pattern here. As I change the relative phase from plus to minus, this interference pattern moves so that the maximum will appear in the minimum. And if I randomize the phase, then I completely lose interference. So the relative phase is the important element that governs interference. So let me now ask, which are the variables that encode information about the phase? So as you learned probably long ago, you have to look at the averages of different observables. So let me first look what is the average value of x. Okay, let's do here the computation. The average value of x is integral from minus infinity to infinity, psi of x star, x, psi of x, dx, which is equal integral minus infinity to infinity, 1 over root 2, psi 1 of x star plus e minus psi alpha psi 2 of x complex conjugate times x times 1 over root 2 psi 1 of x e I alpha psi 2 of x dx. Now this integral decomposes into four terms. So it's 1 over 2 in front, psi 1 of x complex conjugate x psi 1 of x plus psi 2 of x complex conjugate x psi 2 of x. Note that psi 2 and psi 2 the phase terms just drop because I have minus alpha plus alpha. And then I have the mixed terms, 1 over 2 integral psi 1 of x star x ei alpha psi 2 of x plus convex one. All right. Now, this term doesn't depend on alpha. There is no alpha there. There is no alpha here. This term and the complex conjugate are the only two terms that contain information about alpha. Well, actually, they don't have it. Because remember, psi 1 of x has no overlap with psi 2 of x. Where psi 1 of x is non-zero, psi 2 is zero. Therefore, this term is zero, and the complex conjugate is zero. So that means that the average value of x is independent of alpha. Good. What about x to some power n? Well, let me see. X to the power n, I just put an n here to the x. Well, this doesn't change things too much, because in the mixed term, doesn't matter whether it was x or x squared and so on. It is still the fact that psi 1 doesn't overlap with psi 2. So we find that all averages of x are independent of that. Good. Let's see now what about the momentum p. Well, what is the average of p? P average is I d over dx of that thing. So it's put an I outside d over dx. So again, it's an I over 2 integral psi 1 star d over dx psi 1 plus I over 2 psi 2 star d over dx psi 2. Again, in the terms with psi 2, the phase drops. Plus I over 2 psi 1 star d over dx e to the I alpha psi 2 plus complex conjugate. Again, the phase alpha comes only in the mixed terms. But psi 1 and d over dx of psi 2 still have no overlap. Because since psi 2 lives only in this region, the derivative with respect to x still lives only in that region. So this is 0, and the complex conjugate is 0. And p is also independent of alpha. Now, what about p to some power n? Well, p to the n, in the nth derivative here, and that doesn't affect the fact that where psi 2, psi 1 is 0, psi 2 is different from 0, and the other way. So that means that p to anything, let me put p to the k, is independent of alpha. And of course, you can find immediately that any term like p to the n, k, x to the n, is independent of alpha. OK, you may worry that this is not a Hermitian thing. Take this plus Hermitian function. Right. So where is the information about the interference? In fact, every observable is a function of x and p. And we found that every combination, the average of any combination of x and p, is independent of alpha. But alpha is the thing that governs interference. So we must find it somewhere. Okay? So that's the question. Where is it? Okay. Well, if I had more time, I would leave that as a problem and come only tomorrow. But that would be too easy on me, and I'm supposed to talk too much today. Okay, it comes into e to the I p l over h bar, where l, let me consider this to be the distance f. So let's look at the average of this gap. Okay? Well, let's go and compute it.
Sandy.
Yes.
There's a chamois sitting, if you turn around, by the chalk cloth.
Yes. Is it better?
It cleans it much better, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so e to the I p l over h bar average. It's the integral psi star of x e to the I p l over h bar psi of x dx.
Sorry, what is
it? It went up to phi.
Oh, okay.
It's simply a number which is the distance between the two wave packets. Okay? What is this? Well, it is psi star of x. What is this operator applied to psi of x? Very good. Who said it? Psi of x plus l dx. I don't guarantee that it's x plus l or x minus l, but okay. You will catch me. So, 1 over 2, psi 1 of x star plus e I alpha minus I alpha, psi 2 x star times psi 1 x plus l plus e I alpha psi 2 x plus l dx. So let's see. The term x1 with x1 of x plus l gives 0 because I had x1 psi of x1 here and the other one moved. Moved which way x plus l? It's moved outwards. Psi 2 with a psi 2 of x plus l again gives 0. Psi 2 with psi 1 of x plus l, by now psi 1 moves even further. But we have this beautiful term here, e psi 1 of x star e to the I alpha psi 2 of x plus l dx. Psi 2 of x plus l simply moves this one over there. So their overlap is 1. So this result simply gives 1 over 2 e to the alpha. So this operator, depends on alpha. Of course, this is not Hermitian, but you can look at sine and cosine of PL divided by H bar. Yes?
Am I missing something?
For sure.
Analysis, because this operator is just the sum of operators.
Oh, good. Yes. What you are missing is problem number one in homework. And problem number one in homework is e to the I PL over H bar can be written as sum over n, what is that? I p l over h bar to the n divided by n factorial. Now I know, so in particular this is sum over I l over h bar to the n 1 over n factorial p to the n. And I just claim that p to any power, the average of it is independent of alpha. So how comes that when I take the average e to the I p l over h bar average, sum over n I l to the power n h bar 1 over n factorial p to the n, that this thing depends on alpha. Okay? Both things are true. So here comes the, this is your first exercise. Try to find out what that was. Okay? When you find out, you will understand something very nice about quantum mechanics. But this is a mathematical nicety, and I don't want to stay on. By the way, you may worry that when I take too many derivatives there to look into p, I may run into some trouble because that function is with compact support, so surely something wrong may go on at the ends of it. That is not the case, because you know that this function is indeed non-analytic, because outside is zero, so just looking at the form outside, you would not know what shape the function has. But it could be seen here. So there are functions that you can take that have compact support, and they are zero outside. So an example of that function would be e to minus 1 over x squared minus a squared, where a, well, this thing is 2a. So this is exercise number n0 outside. So this for x, or smaller than a, and this other ones. So you get your exercise number 2. Try to prove that this is c infinite, that is, the derivatives with respect to x at the point where x is equal to a or to minus a are always fine. In fact, they are always zero. Right. So, let me go back. It is this wonderful operator, e to the I p l over h bar, that encodes information about interference. And it is this operator that I want to go ahead and analyze what is it doing. Okay? The information is not in x and not in p. It is in e to the I p l over h mod. Good. So let's try to ask some. Did you copy your homework assignment? Good. Ask your tutors to solve. Yes, you're right. So one thing you can immediately tell about that operator, that's a shift operator. That is a non-local operator. An operator that takes away function from here and moves it over there. Okay? It's not a local operator, like x or like p.
Could you just also consider, say, the square root of the momentum operator that contains also an infinity of derivatives, yes?
I have to think about it. But, okay. Be- before going and talking about this operator, there's something else quite interesting here. What you found, just look at the distribution of, say, the probability to get the momentum p. Okay? The probability distribution of getting the momentum p for the function psi of alpha. There must be, you should plot something here, the momentum p, and here is the probability of p. And you would have some distribution here. Now, what did we just prove? For different alphas, so for different psi alphas, I have different probability distributions. But these probability distributions have the same moments of the distribution. That is, the average of p and the average of all powers of p, they are all the same. So here we have an example. Generally, it is supposed that if I have a probability distribution of some variable, and I look at all the moments, that all the moments, you know, if I have a variable, a random variable x, and I look at x of n, and if somebody gives me all these numbers, then it's equivalent of knowing the probability distribution of this random variable. That is absolutely false, because here we had an example in which by changing alpha, we change the probability of p. And I know I change it because there is some function of p whose average is changed. And yet, the two probabilities have the same moments. Okay? So exercise number 3 is take those two functions and see how plot the probability distribution as a function of alpha and see how it changes. Okay? Do I need to write here the test? Take the wave function psi alpha and plot the probability of p for the function psi alpha. So do it for alpha equals 0, and so do it for psi 1 plus psi 2, psi 1 minus psi 2. Plot probability of p in these two cases. They must be such that all the average of the momentum and all its powers are the same, but yet the probability distributions are different. So that's a nice exercise. Right. Good. So there we are. So suppose now that I have this particle, and I affect it by Hamiltonian. H, for example, p squared over 2m plus some v of x. Just out of time. Let's see what is the equation of motion for different observables. Now, here is a place where many people who try to think of the equations of motion of quantum mechanics, they make a mistake. They look at the Heisenberg equations of motion, and they say, well, they are very similar to the classical equation of motion. So what is the equation of motion for dA over dt in general for some observable A? If A is time independent, then this is I over h bar h a. Correct? H bar? Okay, let's forget the h bar for the time being. So, what is the equation of motion for x? So, x dot, which is dx over dt, is I, it's I x times the Hamiltonian, which would be minus that. So, let me put A H. So it is x commutator with v squared over 2m plus v of x. By the way, are you familiar with Heisenberg equations of motion? Is there anybody who's not familiar? Of course, there will be no time for this. Okay. The one who is not familiar should come and talk to me after. The ones. Okay. So what is this? Well, x commutes with v of x, so I can't forget that thing. So this is I, x, 2m goes out, p squared, x with p squared, this is I, 2p over 2m, times the, let me do it slowly, I over 2m, and I have two terms, p and the commutator of xp, plus xp and the commutator of p. This gives p over n. Here I get an I, there I get an I, with this I, and with a minus sign that I didn't put correctly, just with p over n. So if I write here the equations of motion, the equation of motion for x is x dot equals p over m. Let me derive what is the equation of motion for p. The equation of motion for p is p dot equals I h p equals I p squared over 2m plus v of x commutator with p equals p commutes with a term in p squared, so it's I v of x p, and this is simply minus dv over dx. Again, probably I just had minuses and pluses inverted, but I corrected them on the way, knowing what the results must be. These are the Heisenberg equation of motion for the operator x and operator p for a particle in a potential. They are identical to the classical equation of motion. So, many people who thought of it and who also discussed about Hamilton equations classically and so on, got to the conclusion that, well, now we understand quantum mechanics. It has the same equations of motion, but it has uncertainties. The wave function is uncertain, and that makes some difference. Well, there can be nothing wronger than this. This is fundamentally wrong, because they looked only to some simple observables. They looked to x, and they looked to p. But we see that none of them encodes information about the interference. So what I should look for, I should look for d over dt of e to the I cl over h bar. That is the observer, the observable that is of interest for me. And I should check the equation of motion for that. Okay? I have 5 more minutes or whatever. So, what is the big deal about doing that? Well, we know what that is. D over dt e to the I pl over h bar should be, I can write as d over dp e to the I pl over h bar times dp over dt. So this gives il over h bar e to the I pl over h bar times p dot. And p dot is, so equals I L over H bar e to the I P L over H bar with a minus sign dv over dx. And it is identical to plus. Yes? Did I hear something?
Just making sure that right now you're doing the classical case, right? Not the quantum mechanical, because I'm kind of concerned about the d by dp.
You are concerned about that?
If it's quantum mechanical.
Is anybody else concerned? Yes. You are right to be concerned. That is exactly the point.
Okay.
To get the time derivative, one shouldn't do this. This is simply for classical functions. You have to go back and do the normal quantum thing, which you remember is there. It's I, the commutator of the thing. So let me go and do that. Let me do it. So d over dt e to the I p l over h bar must be I, the Hamiltonian, times e to the I p l over h bar. So it is I p squared over 2m plus v of x e I p l over h bar. I can forget about the term in p squared over 2m because it commutes with any function of p. And let me write explicitly what is the commutator. So that is v of x e to the I p l over h bar minus e to the I p l over h bar v of x. Let me take e to the I, by the way, there was an h bar, e to the I p l over h bar, let me take it outside, and then I have e minus I p l over h bar v of x e to the I p l over h bar minus v of x. I just took this term out, and I added e to minus I p l over h bar here. Now, what is this? I apply the shift operator to the function v of x. So this is I over h bar e to the I p l over h bar v of x plus l minus the other. All right. So let me put it here. It's a good formula E of I over H bar E to the I P L over H bar V of X plus L minus V of X. Let me divide this by L, multiply here by L. And what is classical? This should have been classical. I L over H bar e to the I P L. I L over H bar e to the I P L. But here, classically, I have the derivative of V with respect to X. While here I have the difference of V between two points divided by the distance. This is not a local operator. Here I have the difference between the potential at the location x and at a faraway location x plus l. So, and there need not be any force. That is, I may have a potential that looks like that. Here is some location x, and there is a location x plus l. So that is constant here and constant there. So the upshot, and with this I will finish my first tower is that all information about interference is contained into a non-local observable, and this non-local observable obeys non-local equations of motion. So there is no locality in the basic equations of motion of quantum mechanics. And you can think, you know, the basic question was, how comes that a particle would go through one slit and feels whether the other slit is open or closed? Well, because that affects the potential that the particle sees. It sees the potential next to the slit. And going through one of them is affected by what happens next to the other, because that is the observer, the observable that contains the information. Okay? Yes?
So, do you have some simple physical interpretation to offer that classical reasoning gets it right when L is small? Whereas I would really, so my intuition would have told me, okay, so classical reasoning will get it right when L is large. I just want the particles are far away.
That would be a wrong intuition.
Yeah, I see.
Try to do h bar small. That is one way, but that is actually cheating. Classically, well, classically you never start with a particle that is in two-way packets that do not overlap. That is one thing. There you will see. Now the equation of motion remains valid, whether or not the two-way packets overlap or not. But in order to see interesting effects, you would need the wave function to be able to explore two regions of space where V is different. Otherwise, this will give zero, and that will give zero. So although the equation of motion remains true, no matter what the wave function is, and this is what is important for equations of motion, but if the wave packet is localized just in a region where the potential doesn't change, and doesn't explore it, you will see no difference. Now, once you have a wave function that is extended enough so as to sample different potentials, that is no longer classical. Okay? But I will talk in more detail how you go from classical and what happens at the classical limit and so on in the next topic.
What's wrong with being non-local? It's not an observer.
Oh, make it to Hermitian, take cosine.
Is it an observable then?
Yeah, if I take this plus complex conjugate, what will happen? You'll just get cosine. That's not a problem. Or, I don't, you'll get with this and move on the other side, it's still the same.
Sure, but does it have an intuitive physical meaning?
Ah, that's a good thing. Intuitive. You need to develop your intuition about it. And all that I start telling you is what I... No, really, it's not a joke. It is, but... The point is, you need to develop your intuition in the correct direction. And as long as your intuition was guided by the fact that, well, it's just a wave, it interferes, we know waves on water, we know everything, and you try to develop an intuition in that direction, you could develop some intuition, but it would be wrong. And that's why we are still lacking a good intuition about quantum mechanics. Now, this is the direction in which one should develop intuition. And now you should start playing with these variables. By the way, they are called modular variables, and I will tell you next hour why. So these are the variables about which you have to think, and you will have to play with them. And then you will develop a good intuition about that. Okay, let's take a break.
So let's meet back here in 15 minutes after taking sentences.